Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have our work cut out for us, Rabbit. We have such a backlog of interviews because what happens is when you're approaching the holidays, the publishers release this list of books just en masse for the holidays, and there you are with all these good interviews.
Yeah, so we have three great ones for you today.
Exactly.
Three masters of their field.
Classics.
Undoubtedly. First up, we have someone who knows more than anyone else in the whole universe, it seems, about olive oil and wrote a book about it, which we had a very fascinating conversation with him.
Tom Mueller. He was really good, yeah.
And then we have, I guess, you could call it Latino cuisine from the old world and the new world. Experts in both Spanish cooking and cooking of the new world.
The Spanish cooking would not like to be called Latino.
Well, I'm just trying to
which
suggest.
Which has to do with Latin America.
Well, we have new world and old world Spanish, right, if you like to put it that way. So don't be so argumentative all the time. I'm just trying to hook these things together so our listeners will think that we're somewhat organized, even though perhaps we're not. Anyway, who could put down a book whose title is Extra Virginity? It seems like perhaps the author ought to be interviewed by Matt Lauer and Meredith Vieira and Ann Curry on the Today Show.
I think he was.
But the subject is entirely different and really quite fascinating.
When you pick up a book and it says Extra Virginity on the front, I think you have to be really careful where you leave it around your house. People might be thinking that there's a little amateur pornography going on here, but this is a most outrageously detailed book, and I found not perhaps the most obscure, but one of the most obscure comments in it, which gives you an idea that Tom Mueller has spent his life going through the world finding out about olives. Did you know that, first of all, there's a monastery in Western Australia that's been growing olives for more than 100 years, and the kangaroos don't like olives, but the parrots do? So there. See, you thought I didn't read your book, Tom, but I really did.
Well, I wonder why kangaroos don't like olive oil.
They can't hold them in their hands.
Too slippery.
They don't know how to pick them up.
They can harvest them, but they just can't press them.
But seriously, folks, there's a book that we interviewed the author of a book about 3 or 4 years ago called The Billionaire's Vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ben Wallace was the name of the author. And I don't know if you have ever seen the book, but perhaps it was simply your outrage at what was happening in the world of olive oil that caused you to want to write this book and explain some things about olives that are going on that you're not very proud of, as well as some things about olives that you clearly are very proud of.
The subtitle is The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil, so that we have an equal dose of what's really good about olive oil. And Tom, am I correct that you are a writer for the New Yorker magazine? And that this grew out of a column that you had written on olive oil.
That's right. I'm a freelance writer, and I contribute to the New Yorker, among others. And my whole entry into olive oil started with a conversation with my editor, and the topic of olive oil came up, and it seemed like a good one to tackle. And I really didn't know what I was getting into. And the deeper I went, the more I realized that although I had been living in Italy for upwards of 10 years at that point, and had tasted some good oil, it was a vastly more complex and fascinating and murky subject than I had dreamed. And it started to make sense out of certain things that I was seeing, like the abandonment of trees and honest growers making magnificent oil and not being able to sell it for a reasonable price and not to be able to recover their costs, as I started to understand the darker side of olive oil, which is the fraudulent side, which since ancient times has been.
I was going to say it goes back forever, so it must be something that's easy to do for big profit. Why would the Egyptians be so concerned about it and the Romans?
That's right. It is basically a very expensive. Olive oil is one of the, really the only commercially significant vegetable oils to be made from a fruit, and it requires high quality fruit. Other vegetable oils are made from seeds and nuts, and since they're all refined, everything except olive oil, then you can really start with any sort of seed and nut, any quality, and produce industry standard sunflower seed oil or soybean oil. But olive oil requires a fruit, and a good, an extra virgin olive oil, a good quality olive oil requires high-quality fresh fruit, which means you have to take care of the tree all year long, and then when the time comes to harvest it, you have to choose the right moment to harvest, quickly harvest everything off the tree, rush it to the mill before it starts to go off, because remember, it's a stone fruit like a cherry or a plum, and as soon as you pick those, they start to degrade. You make your oil, and you store it carefully in a cool, dark place under nitrogen and sell it, and as fresh fruit juice, people need to eat it fairly quickly. That's the good stuff. The other stuff is made by an industrial process that basically dumbs down bad olive oil, removes the bad tastes and smells because it's been made with substandard fruit, and then sells the product basically under the same label, extra virgin olive oil. And sadly, there's not enough oversight to distinguish those two products, and therefore the people who are making the good stuff and spending a lot of time and money making it are losing out in unfair competition with the people who make the industrial stuff and actually have very low...
Now, it's interesting that we talked earlier on about the fact that, you know, why has crime been associated with olive oil for such a long time? But if you think about it, people think of murder as being the first crime that was ever committed when Cain slew his brother Abel. Mm-hmm. But in fact, if you go back earlier than that, fraud was actually perpetrated by the snake.
So Tom, we don't know what you're waiting for here.
So it actually involved the fresh fruit, the apple.
So it's not really surprising that fraud entered the olive oil business. But talk to us. Let's do the scandalous part first.
Can we do the tasting part first? Because that's...
Well, yeah, we can if you like, but that's just...
Oh, all right,
you
do the scandalous.
You just contradict
then.
Exactly what I said.
Okay, well,
you usually do that, so that's okay.
So we're doing tasting, are we?
No, we're going to do scandalous. He's the boss.
Well, as you say, it goes back in history. I mean, the very first mention of olive oil in literature, 24 centuries B.C., on cuneiform tablets, you read olive oil in the context of olive oil fraud squads going around to check the mills to see if the millers were getting up to mischief. It's a high-priced thing. It's a high-priced product that can be easily diluted with lower-priced vegetable oils and sold at a high price. So it's been attractive for a long time. But there is something also, the fact that it's an ingredient rather than drunk neat like wine perhaps allows it to be masked more easily. But there is something kind of proverbial about grease the palm, oil the works. There's something about olive oil that sort of is connected with fraud in ways that I haven't fully understood.
Now, there are a couple of things going on, I think, aren't there? One is fraud to do with the origin,
mm-hmm.
and then the
mm-hmm.
second one is fraud to do with the quality.
That's right, yeah. The extreme cases, or at least the most eye-catching cases, are the ones where people take the sunflower seed oil or soybean oil or peanut oil and mix it with some colorant and some flavoring, sometimes with a little bit of olive oil too, but sometimes neat, and sell the result as extra virgin olive oil. And that's pretty eye-catching, but needless to say, that produces something that is, from a nutritional and health and culinary point of view, significantly less attractive than extra virgin olive oil. Another big problem, somewhat less eye-catching but equally damaging to the honest producer, is when companies take low-quality olive oil, make it made from olives that quite often are substandard or even rotten or moldy, then deodorize it, which is a low-temperature refining process, which produces an oil which is completely neutral, no bad smells, no good smells, and quite often with substandard nutritional properties, and sell that as extra virgin, sometimes spiced with a little bit of real extra virgin just to give it some character. And again, that comes from olives, but it's not extra virgin, and for those honest producers who are making the real stuff, to see their product side by side on the shelves of a supermarket with this fake industrial that sells for €1.85 a liter on the bulk market is crushingly difficult to fight against.
Now, you put us into a position where we've got to actually attack this core issue of what are the requirements for extra virgin oil.
Virgin oil just means something that's been made with physical processes, like been crushed and then either pressed the old-fashioned way or spun out with a centrifuge. So that's physical process. No chemicals, no heat. And extra virgin is best quality grade of the three grades of virgin oils. So it's oil made with physical means and of a particularly good quality. Now, according to the law, extra virgin olive oil has to meet certain chemical requirements, 27 chemical requirements, and it also has to pass a taste test. And that taste test requires that it remind you in some way, either in taste or in odor, of fresh olives, and that it have no taste defects. There are 17 official taste defects that the European Union, well, the International Olive Council has decreed. And those taste defects include rancidity, mustiness, which comes from moldiness, fustiness, which is a fermented grub, which is from olives that have been infected, well, they've been attacked by the olive fly, and there's a grub inside.
Yeah.
It's rather meaty and unpleasant. dirt or earth, which comes from olives that have been sitting on the ground. Each of these defects comes from an error in the raising of the olives or the production of the oil or the storage of the oil.
And you said in your book that even presence of one of these constitutes that you cannot label it extra virgin, except that everybody ignores the law.
That's correct. Yeah, one taste flaw or smell flaw is enough to disqualify this extra virgin. And many of the supermarket extra virgins that you open will have several taste flaws that leap out. But really, no one's paying much attention to that.
Now, in addition to that, there's also some DOP work, right? So deep DOP, if you like, the fruit and vegetable equivalent of DOC.
Exactly.
Also controls where the olives are actually grown and what the composition is.
Exactly. Yeah, that DOP oils are much more carefully policed. They have a very strict, in most cases, a strict production standard, lower chemical requirements and then the higher chemical requirements. They hold you to a higher standard. And quite often, a series of taste attributes. If you think about it, extra virgin, the definition, it just means that it doesn't stink. It doesn't actually say anything positive about the oil except for that hint of good olives. Now, the DOP requirements quite often, they vary from DOP to DOP, but they quite often require certain positive taste attributes, which is not a bad idea.
Well, now, you open your book with your participation in one of these tasting sessions.
Yes.
I can't remember how many people were involved, but it wasn't a whole lot. When do these tastings go on? How often do they go on? How many people does it involve? How widespread is it?
Yeah, this is very carefully, the taste panel protocol is very carefully laid out by the International Olive Council and by the European Union, and now by the USDA, which has taken those protocols and made it part of the new trade standard for all of it. There are eight people in a tasting panel, eight tasters, with panel head, the ninth person, who sort of administrates the panel and checks to make sure that everyone is following the rules, and then ultimately tots up the result. It's very a proper panel, properly trained, and that means tasting on a regular basis together and comparing notes, making sure that they recognize all of the official flaws. It's actually a very, and then measuring the results according to a statistical protocol that eliminates outliers, so you really get a statistically robust measurement of an oil. Panel, if tasters are good, it's the best method of determining quality, much better than chemical requirements, because the chemistry can always be, say, fiddled, but you can slide by with an oil that really isn't extra virgin at all and actually has some problems in taste with the chemical requirements, but a good taste panel will always catch it. I think an important thing to remember is that the taste flaws of olive oil are not just a matter of snobbishness. They reflect one-to-one problems with the nutritional quality and even the health benefits, or lack thereof, of the olive oil. So if there are serious flaws in an olive oil, it's not going to be nearly as good for you as good oil.
Okay, so there really is a nutritional impact that you need to worry about as well as a taste impact.
Which is very critical. Yeah, you really focus on this a lot. And this is, I think, ultimately you say that the consumer is the one being cheated of the health benefits.
That's right. The properly made extra virgin olive oil is really a cocktail of healthful anti-inflammatories, antioxidants, basically the liquid sort of keystone of the Mediterranean diet. It's why the Mediterranean diet is so healthy. And if someone goes to a store and expects to get that, or their doctor has told them that they should get that, and they reach for something that has soybean oil in it, or really subpar olive oil in it, they're not going to get those same qualities, because those antioxidants and anti-inflammatories are quite often quite perishable and go away when you treat an oil badly or when it's really, really old. So not only are you not getting the good stuff, if you get bad oil, you quite often are getting, if it's rancid, you get free radicals and peroxides and impurities.
So you're not only
not getting the good stuff, you're actually getting some bad stuff, and that's just not fair.
Now, here's an interesting question. Does oil improve as it gets older, or does it decline as it gets older, and over what period of time does that happen?
It's a very good question, and one that confuses a lot of people. It's the exact opposite of most wines. I mean, many wines get better with age.
That's what I figured. Yeah. So
fresh-squeezed fruit juice. I mean, the way to think of it is fresh-squeezed fruit juice.
So we have,
it will never be better than the day it was made.
We have a bottle that we picked up. We were at an agriturismo, which also happens to grow olives and grapes to make wine, and we actually saw, for the first time I had ever seen extra virgin olive oil being produced.
Oh, we just bought that in Sicily.
And we have a bottle. The owner said, would we like a bottle? We said, you bet. We haven't opened it yet, but it's not going to get better.
That's right. No, it will not get better. It will degrade more slowly if you keep it.
Yeah. Okay.
But, and then it really accelerates. The degradation really accelerates once you open the bottle.
Well, you remember she gave us the testing, and the one that you freaked out over was the one that pressed.
Yeah, that's the one she gave us.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. Going to be the most vibrant, bitter, pungent, fruity, all of the real character is going to be there from the fresh fruit, and that's gradually going to disappear. And again, there are 700 different kinds of olives, each making a different, sometimes a radically different kind of oil. And so some oils degrade much faster than others. The more bitterness and pungency it has, typically the more natural preservatives it contains, and therefore the longer it lasts. But that's just a kind of a rule of thumb.
Now let's go on to a slightly different area now. How expensive should the oil be? Good does it have to be useful for different things? And let me go on to explain why. We keep two different varieties of extra virgin olive oil in our house.
Mm-hmm.
We keep one which comes in the large tins, which we use regularly, daily, whenever I'm allowed to cook with it.
But I'm not always.
And then we keep the specialty items, the small bottle samples or the gifts or other things that we buy because we prefer they're really good.
As finishing.
And we use those just for finishing purposes. So we pour those on raw, if you like. Is that a sensible approach?
I think it's a very sensible approach. I give it again in the same terms as I think of wine. There are table wine for an average meal and a special bottle for a special occasion, a moderately good bottle if you're having friends. If they're really good friends, a moderately better bottle. There's all sorts of choices to make.
Right.
But I think that's basically a very good one, and especially if you're cooking at high heat, some of the real health attributes will start to disappear if you're cooking, if you're frying, deep fat frying.
Right.
From a purely health point of view, olive oil, extra virgin olive oil is one of the very best to use, but from a taste point of view, you may find that some of the stronger bitternesses and pungencies become accentuated and the harmony of a really good oil disappears. It's also very expensive stuff.
Yeah.
Again, you wouldn't cook with a $300 Bordeaux, at least I wouldn't. And it's the same sort of thing. If you have a very fancy, very fresh extra virgin olive oil, you probably wouldn't be frying.
Tom, you've tasted undoubtedly a gazillion olive oils. What are some of your heroes? So just as a guide to our listeners, you can do some countries, you could do some individual producers, or regions, mm-hmm. whatever. And who are your heroes?
Well, I have a range of them. One of my very, very favorite types of olive is Cioppella with an R, and it's a very limited production in the area of Naples. But it produces a magnificent, very complex oil. And
what's it again?
Re-cioppella with an R.
Okay.
And it's rare. It's difficult to find, but it's a magnificent. But it was one of my favorites. Another is several oils that are made by Australian producer Boundary Bend that makes some very, very good oils from around the world. And what I discovered, so I should say, from olives from around the world, but they make it right there in Australia.
Who is this?
The company is called Boundary Bend.
Western Australia.
Yeah, it's Victoria,
that's where we used to live, hadn't it?
Yeah, and they have a wide range of olive varietals from around the world, and some of their oils. This year, I think they won two best of shows in the Los Angeles County Fair. It's superb. Superb stuff. And then there's some wonderful oils that I've had in Spain, the Castillo de Canena, which I talk about in my book, which is really right in the heart of an area where they produce huge amount of very low-quality oil. They're sitting up on a hill in the middle of this sea of low-grade oil and making this magnificent nectar. And some great producers, and there's a fellow called Mike Madison near the town of Davis, who makes everything by hand out of olives that are a varietal called the Tagiasca. Now, where I live in Italy, they make Tagiasca oil very late when the fruit is very ripe, overripe, and sometimes falling to the ground. And it's very soft and not very nice. And I complain occasionally to people there, but they say, well, this is the way we do it. Like it or have something else, this is what we like. But Mike Madison makes this oil from the same varietal, but picked much earlier and produced much better. And it's as if it were from a different tree. It's remarkable.
From a grower's standpoint, you have this sort of, it's the opposite of the law of diminishing returns, right? The riper the olives, the more oil you'll get from them when you press them.
Correct.
But perhaps you'll have lost some quality along the way. So,
very definitely.
So Mike is taking the opposite approach and saying, I'm prepared to settle for less oil because the quality is the thing that I want.
Exactly. And there's a sort of a magic point at which they need to have a certain amount of ripeness or you can't even get the oil out of it. Or they can be unbearably bitter and pungent. It's just like having an unripe cherry or plum. And again, the olive is a relative. It's a stone fruit like a cherry or a plum. If you pick it off the tree too green and hard as a rock, you're not going to have much of an experience.
Yeah, I know.
It has to be ripening, and quite often on the turn is the way to describe it. But each grower and each region has its own way of interpreting what the ideal moment is to pick. And each season, again, it's a seasonal fruit. People forget this.
Yes.
It's not a standard thing that every year it's the same. It's each season, each year produces, and some varietals will do well in a given year, and others right in the same area will do not so well.
Tom, you found a load here. I think it opens up at the next book, which can be on Balsamico, and then you can go on, and there's now Marzano tomatoes.
Yes. In fact, an investigative magistrate, when I asked early on in my work on olive oil, was organized crime involved in the olive oil trade? He said, no, they are organized criminals, but they are not gangsters. And then he said, but if you were working with canned tomatoes, you'd already be dead. And
he
said, wow. Well, you know, I'll think twice before I work on canned tomatoes. But you're right. It's this, the glistening tip of the iceberg of what's happening in many, many foods. And understanding the dynamics of buying cheap wherever and using whatever materials and selling dear under a misleading label is something that has really opened my eyes to a range of things. And I think my next book probably will look at these things, the good news and the bad news, across the food spectrum.
Now, here's the thing you have to do, listeners. You have to piece of brown paper and put it on the outside of this rather elegant book so that people can't see you're reading a book called Extra Virginity.
It does sound like a place on the internet where you wouldn't want your children to go.
But it's just an absolutely fascinating book.
Congratulations.
Thank you very, very much.
Filled with information, both discouraging and encouraging, and lots and lots of details about producers, about how you make the best, what to look for in the best, all of those wonderful things. We could talk to you all day, Don, but we know we have to let you go, and we must return to the program. So thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for this great piece of work.
Well, thank you very much, Peter and Ann. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I've never actually timed our commercial breaks, if it's 1 minute, 2 minutes. Anyhow, they are short.
They're 16 seconds.
Oh, okay. So it's not even a minute.
Just in case you were wondering.
I was wondering.
Yeah, it's not time to go to the bathroom, that's for sure.
Well, anyhow, I don't need to do that.
No, you don't need to do that? Okay.
No.
Well, in that case, let's go on.
And next?
Somebody called Claudia Roden is next. Please introduce her, Anne.
Yes, I think that we could actually call this next book a tome. There's nobody who does research like Claudia Roden, and she's such an expert on Spanish cuisine. And it's kind of book that you really need on your shelf. Claudia Roden, I think that we could call this book that you've produced called The Food of Spain an opus. It's grand. It has been endorsed as one of the best books on Spanish food in the English language by such people as Ferran Adrià, Mario Vitali, Paula Wolfert, and Alice Waters. What an achievement it is. It weighs in at I don't know how much, but it is heavy, and if you include the index, it's over 600 pages. How ever did you manage to produce this, and how long did it
take? It took me 5 years. But I take my time. I don't think of it as a job. It becomes a way of life. And so including traveling, because I would go every so often to Spain, and then I'd come back and do some research and try dishes. And I always try dishes in company. I mean, I invite people round to dinner, and I try them this way. So it takes a lot more time. Very often tried more than once. And the traveling, for me, becomes part of the pleasure of this way of life. And so I never mind how long a book takes me. And in this one, it was particularly fascinating for me to travel and meet people and to do it as a leisure activity almost.
Ah, but now you really have a much longer or larger curve having to do with this cuisine, the food of Spain, because of your ancestral roots.
Yes, because I'm a Sephardi Jew from Egypt.
Yeah, but, born in Cairo,
Born in Cairo, but one of my grandmothers was from Istanbul, but she was so proud of her Spanish ancestry. She spoke in Judeo-Spanish.
I never knew that existed. I was surprised when I read that.
It is medieval Spanish. And it is a Jewish medieval Spanish. And it was the Spanish of the time when the Jews lived in Spain. And they left, in her case, in great masses in 1492. And they kept on in her family and her community in Turkey speaking this old Spanish. And also cooking foods which they said were from Spain. They were proud of that.
Well, now you are recognized, especially with all of your other important books, the award-winning, I might say, including the major study of the Middle Eastern food and the Mediterranean food. But your particular talent is integrating history, social and other history, and cultural factors into the cuisine of whatever you're writing about.
Yes, I started early on doing that because when I started writing about Middle Eastern food, it was when my parents had to leave Egypt. I was in London studying art, and all my community, my Jewish community of Egypt, had to leave after the Suez Crisis. So they were coming out in big masses, and that's when I started collecting recipes. But at that time in England, people thought of Middle Eastern food and Egyptian food as just sheep's eyes and testicles.
Oh, dear.
And I felt, really, we have to explain that it isn't just that. But not only that, I felt I had to tell them something about the culture and what these dishes represent, what they mean, for them to even want to try them. So in a way, I started researching old manuscripts of food and old cultural things as well, but so as to give people some background to a dish. And somehow it's become my interest wherever I go to look up what's behind a dish, and there's always a story, and the story adds up, all the stories of all the dishes, to the story of Spain in this case.
Well, you have some references that I was just not even vaguely aware of. You start out, in terms of organization of your book, with historical influences, and you go through Celts, Romans, and Visigoths as one chapter, then the Andalus, that's the Islamic, and then you go through the Jewish legacies, and then all the New World thing. One of the things that struck me was you said until this food came back from the New World, there was no color in Spanish food. It was the chilies and the tomatoes that gave it color.
Yes.
Right? And then, then you talk about the French influence, which I also was not that aware of, except for in Catalonia. I know that is true. And you had revelations about the aristocracy. Basically, there wasn't, was there? The aristocracy, apparently, they didn't cook, so it wasn't the influence of the aristocracy. And then the other thing that is very interesting was the monasteries and the convents. Because explained that the noble women, if they were not married, would have to go to the convent, and they would take their maids with them. And the maids were all Islamics, right?
Yes. converted to Catholicism.
Right.
By force.
Right, by force. Which they did also to the Jews, yes. But then all these wonderful pastries that came out of the convents really have their origins in the world of Islam,
Yes.
So I just thought that was fascinating.
Yes, and they tell you that. And, you know, when you know Islamic-type pastries, which are with almonds and sugar syrup, pine nuts, or you recognize them right away as of Arab influence.
Well, now, can you just run us through things that people might not know about, did the Moors contribute to the cuisine? I mean, a lot. Great, really,
yes.
A lot.
Yes. Well, the Moors came to Spain in 711. The Arabs coming actually from Syria and Saudi Arabia had come, and they had first conquered Morocco and North Africa.
I said they came the long way around. They took the land route.
Yes.
All the way across North Africa and then crossed somewhere near Gibraltar.
Yes, and they crossed in 711. And their soldiers were mainly Berbers who came from North Africa, from the mountains, whom they had recently converted to Islam. And they quickly conquered the whole country, right up to the north, except a little enclave, a tiny enclave. And then gradually, over the centuries, the Catholic kings, because there were many kingdoms in Spain at the time, and they gradually fought to push them back to the south. And until 1492, when the last Muslim king gave up the keys of Granada. That was his last stronghold. He gave up the keys and left.
Yes.
And from then on, from 1492, it was a Christian country. And at the same time, the Spanish king expelled the Jews. So 1492 was an important year. It was the year when Christopher Columbus sailed off to discover the New World. He was going to discover the Indies, the spices, and he set off then. But the Muslims were allowed to stay and keep their religion, but not for long. After a while, they were forced to convert to Christianity. And also, all the Jews who stayed, about half of the Jews who were in Spain, they were a minority. The Muslims were a bigger minority, much bigger. But the Jews, also half of the people who were there, decided to stay in Spain. And they stayed as conversos. Conversos means converted Jews to Christianity. And the Muslims stayed as Moriscos, which meant that they were converted. So there was this multicultural society that created something very, very unique and very special, which was a Hispano-Moorish culture. And it was, of course, Spain had received its language from Rome, from the Romans, and its Christianity as well from the Visigoths when they came. So their culture, of course, is Roman and Visigoth early on, but what I found that certainly in the point of view of food, there is such a very powerful Arab and or Muslim influence. And also, you find Jewish as well.
Now, of course, it depends on the section of the country. Describe three separate sections, really, not the absolute regionalism that you encounter in Italy, but mainly having to do with the land or the sea or the mountains, right?
Yes. Let's say that Spain is, because it is so geographically diverse. There is so much difference geographically that obviously the kind of things that grow there are different because the climate is different, the soil is different. But on the other hand, it is then extremely regional, even more than Italy. But unlike Italy, the food and the cultural, the cuisines in the borders of the regions, the old historic regions, the foods have moved from one region to another. And so it isn't a clear-cut type of food map, if you gave a food map. And one of the reasons is, for instance, in the north. Well, the north is, you can divide Spain, as you said, between the north, the interior, the center, and the Mediterranean seacoast. And the north is really near the Atlantic. It's wet and it's cold. It's especially wet. And when you go there, you just see how green it is. And because it's so green, then they can have cows. So they have cows and they have cheese and they have milk and so on. But at the same time, in the north, they have a French culture because of many reasons. But one of the reasons is that Santiago de Compostela, at the westernmost point of Spain, had a place of pilgrimage, which is known as Santiago de Compostela. And it is still a place of pilgrimage, but it was one of the great places of pilgrimage, almost second after Jerusalem for Christians.
And not only that, Claudia, but you could actually get there, whereas after the Crusades it became increasingly difficult to get to Jerusalem.
Exactly. So it was almost a crusading place for crusaders. Mm-hmm. But the first and the largest number of pilgrims who came were French. And they came across because they are neighboring country, neighbors to the north, and they came in through Catalonia, and they came in through various parts, and they traveled across all the regions in the north, and they came walking. And for centuries then, not only did they come all the way walking, but they also settled along the way, and in quite a few towns, there were communities of French people, and these French people opened hostelries and inns, and so they were, in a way, their food came very early on in the north. But another reason, I'm just going this way and going into different directions, but another reason why French cuisine was very much cuisine of the aristocracy and the cuisine of the elite is that when they had actually a French dynasty as their kings, the Bourbons were the kings, and even now the king today is a Bourbon. And
that's true.
The
first
French king was actually the grandson of Louis XIV. And at the time of Louis XIV was when French cuisine developed in Paris. And his grandson brought French cuisine to the court.
Well, now, let's not forget, though, that this is really a cookbook, just so our listeners understand that they're also going to have access to really wonderful recipes. You're including in here traditional recipes as opposed to, say, the newly evolved gastronomy of Spain. And they're traditional, and they're the kinds of recipes that people can cook at home. Is that correct, Claudia?
Absolutely. That is what I always look for, the kind of things that people always cook. And in a way, it is a strange thing to go into a country where the chefs are all fascinated and the catering schools, all the young people in the catering schools want to use technology and science, and they want all to be like Ferran Adrià.
Yeah.
And so when I have been to restaurants, which I have also gone a lot to restaurants, and they bring me fabulous food and I love what they cook, and they come and I say, can you give me recipes from your home?
Oh, that's cute.
So they find it a bit strange, but that is what I'm looking for.
Well, say a reader, someone who's using your cookbook, what are the great traditional just some of the great traditional recipes they can find in your cookbook?
Well, let's say that a lot of the foods are rustic foods, because until not very many years ago, until the middle of the 20th century, 80% of the population lived in the country and off the land in one way or another. And now it's the reverse. 80% live in towns. But the kind of foods that developed as the foods of Spain were mainly peasant food, country food. And that's also what the aristocracy ate. I should say, because the aristocracy were not like the French aristocracy that spent their time in salons. The Spanish aristocracy was a fighting military aristocracy, because they spent nearly all the centuries fighting, first fighting the Muslims to regain their land, then fighting the Dutch, on all sides, and also fighting to conquer the New World. And so they came back and brought back foods, but mainly they had a somehow ascetic type of culture. They were as military men would have. But so to say, what are the foods of Spain in the way the rustic foods were mainly on soups, bean dishes, because that's what they cooked. That was what was cheap. The beans arrived from the New World. They had chickpeas and black-eyed peas, but all many, many different types of beans came from the New World, and that formed what the peasant ate. In the north, they also ate corn, sweet corn, which
really?
We call corn on the cob, and they made it into a polenta type. The peasantry ate potatoes. A lot of things that came from the New World came and became peasant food that the middle classes and the aristocracy wouldn't eat. And they were mainly vegetables and beans and pulses. They didn't eat much meat.
But if they were eating meat, they liked the lamb a lot, you said.
That it was really a sheep-rearing country. They had mainly sheep. And one reason is that the Christian kings and the Christian armies, because the kingdoms were always moving, because they were gaining land and repopulating land that the Muslims had lived in. And it was easier to bring livestock. So they brought sometimes bulls and cows. But mostly they were sheep raising. The aristocracy, in a way, their main income was sheep raising. At first it was sheep raising for wool, and then it became sheep raising for meat and for cheese. But that's the fact that you mentioned sheep makes me say that I forgot to say the kind of reasons why food moved, dishes moved. Because there are a whole lot of dishes that aren't in one region, there are in several regions. And they are called del pastor, it means of the shepherd. And they are dishes that shepherds brought because the sheep had to travel longer. They moved to go to new pastures. They kept moving along routes crisscrossing the whole of Spain. So you find dishes in different parts that are the same. You also find dishes on the routes where the mules brought products from the sea down to the center. And these were usually things like salt cod, because the land was so difficult to cross because of the high, high mountains in Spain. And there was no transport until the 1960s. And so it was mules who used to bring salt cod. Salt cod was the main fish that the Spaniards could eat in the center of Spain when they were away from the sea, which the center of Spain is a huge, enormous part of Spain. And so on their route, there are several dishes that are called al ajo arriero. It means the arriero means the man, the muleteers.
Right.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah. Mules.
So they were the transportation. Well,
Claudia, you know so much. I mean, and there's so much information in this book. I think that our listeners are going to have some idea of this is like the only book you ever will need on the traditional cooking of Spain.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. But I think even so, I could have put many more dishes. I had to make a choice. I tried a lot more. And for instance, now the regions who are trying to regain their culture, because at the time of Franco, who was a dictator, he had tried to suppress the distinctive cultures of Spain. And he hadn't allowed, for instance, the Catalans and the Basques to speak their
language. But now it's totally reversed. They're all
reversed.
The Basque, the Catalans. Well, this
everybody.
Is the
and
whole
the Valencia.
The whole landscape of Spain is just the gastronomic landscape of Spain is so rich, and you've done such great justice to it in your book. I just want to make sure that we say it's Claudia Roden. And it's called The Food of Spain. And I think that it's more than just, it's a reference book as well as a recipe book and a joy to read.
And listeners, if you get it right now, you might just about have time to finish it before the sequel comes out in 5 years.
But I think if the Catalans have collected 900 recipes and Galicians 600.
Yes, well, there are a lot of recipes.
And so, in a way, what I've got, still not all of the recipes.
You keep going, Claudia.
Yeah, they call it the Food of Spain, part two of 10.
Oh, Claudia, thank you so much for calling.
It's a pleasure. And thank you for speaking to me.
Yes, thank you, dear. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back in 16 seconds.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and I'm reminded, especially since we're in presidential campaign era, that I probably misspoke earlier on by saying that Spanish cuisine was Latin, but I can't resist mentioning good old vice presidential candidate Dan Quayle, who said he wished he'd studied Latin in school so he could talk to all the people in Latin America.
And South America.
So anyway, everything Latino is sweeping the country. There's no question about it. If you go to a southern city like Miami, you will certainly find that, and you'll find that I don't know if you saw this, that all the grocery coupons, all the clipping coupons,
they now
are in English and Spanish.
Oh, that's good.
So our Latino citizens must clip coupons too. But that's not what we're talking about. Lorena Garcia is a true expert.
Yeah, she's interested, trained as a lawyer, and lives as a cook, and she's a TV personality.
Sounds like an intelligent direction to go in.
And this is another one. We actually, the book was released, and we recorded this interview celebrating National Hispanic Awareness Month, but it was in October that we interviewed her, so we're dead behind schedule.
Well, we're still Hispanic aware, and you should be too, so let's hear it for Lorena.
Lorena. Well, my mouth is literally watering over these fabulous new Latin classic recipes in a book written by Lorena Garcia, who is, you were a very talented chef. You were on television. You have a restaurant, do you?
Yes, I do. The first one, I've worked a few at the airports here. The first one is here in Miami, Florida, and we'll continue to open a few more throughout the country.
Okay, so it's a chain in your television. Currently, you're on America's Next Great Restaurant?
Yes, that's a series that I did with Bobby Flay and Curtis Stone and Steve Ells. It was actually a great experience that air last year. Now I'm currently producing and shooting my television shows in Latin America in Utilísima, which is almost like a Food Network in the United States, but it's tailored to all Latin America. So it's from Argentina all the way to the United States and Spanish-speaking countries in Europe.
Oh, okay.
And as we mentioned before, you were speaking to us today from the capital of Latin America, which is Miami, Florida.
Yes.
and you've been there quite a long time.
Absolutely. I've been here over 20 years, but I'm still keeping my Latin roots, and being from Venezuela is something that I keep so much close to my heart. And, you know, that's why my book, Lorena Garcia's New Latin Classics, when I said it's new, fresh ideas, that the food that we're comfortable with, and it's doing that. It's representing the Latin culture in the United States in the best possible way, with recipes that are easy to make, that are accessible, that are practical, and at the same time, you will always look great at the time that you make.
Yes, and you're really interested in this issue of childhood obesity, right?
Yes, absolutely. I have a program that is called Big Chef Fido Chef, and I partnered up with the Alliance for a Healthy Generation, which is an organization that was created by the Clinton Global Initiative and the American Heart Association. And what we do is really promote healthy eating in schools, in the community, even in the doctor's office and the household, and how to promote the good choices and healthy eating in the family. And that's something that a cause that I'm very close to. I believe that it is a problem that we're facing in the United States, obesity and you know, all the ramifications of that epidemic, and doing the best that we can to educate our children on how to eat right.
Well, if you tell people that if they eat what you eat, they'll look like you, I think you'd have a lot of converts.
And Lorena's quick to point out, that's not even a very good photograph.
Right.
That's not a good one. That's right.
Now, you have an interesting approach to the organization of the recipes, because it's not just breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You have two particularly interesting chapters, one called Taking the Kitchen Outside,
yes,
and the other for celebration.
Yeah, the way that I cook is the way that I feel. So, for example, I never cook saying, oh, I want to make breakfast. The way that I cook is, oh, wow, I'm in a rush, I need to cook something really fast, or I have time to indulge and spend the weekend with the family, or you know what, I don't want to spend hours in the kitchen, I want to make something that is homey, that is nice, but at the same time, it doesn't take too much time to do it. So I figure, why don't we do the chapters in that way, in the way that we feel of cooking. If we want to be outside, let's make some recipes for the pool or for a picnic. And that's how I decided to do my chapter, really cooking the way that I...
What really distinguishes... You're doing all Latin American food, and so you're not just doing Venezuelan food, which is your background.
That's correct. Yes, and that is something that I wanted to represent. I have a cuisine is highly impacted by Peruvian influences and, you know, Brazilian influences and Japanese and Chinese and all these beautiful tendencies that you find throughout Latin America and around the world. I did my fair share of traveling after culinary school, so really looking for inspiration and trying to find my way and my style of cuisine. And all those influences and inspiration is what came about in my own style of cuisine, which is an international approach to what Latin cuisine is all about. So I use techniques from all over the world, but really keeping the ingredients and the ideas of Latin cuisine, I want it to be represented in the best possible way. And as well, we cook for our state of mind, the way that we feel, and I think that it's very important that we can have in the book, or you can find in my book, recipes that are healthy and also recipes that, you know, that not necessarily have to be healthy, but you can really spend your weekends making food and cooking with your family and friends and really trying to have that magic that happens in the kitchen. I always say that love happens in the kitchen, and something that you always want to be around. And if you think about it, all the gatherings happens around the kitchen.
Oh, they do, indeed.
My house, right?
Right, this is true. Now, every time the book falls open to a new recipe, I think to myself, boy, I really could eat that right now. I want to make that. I'm looking at this pollo con pasión.
Yes, pollo con pasión. I call it pollo con pasión because I'm using passion fruit that in my country is called parchita. And again, one of the things that I wanted to do in my book is cross-utilize ingredients. You know, when you have a cookbook that, for example, asks you for a tablespoon of champagne vinegar, and you don't use it ever again. So you have a beautiful bottle of champagne vinegar in your dispenser or in your dry goods, and you never use it again. So I created a dispenser that can be cross-utilized throughout the book. So that bottle is being used And as long as other ingredients, you're going to be able to use them and reuse them every way. So, for example, the passion fruit, I make a beautiful barbecue sauce with the passion fruit. And then I also have that chicken that I call the passion for passion fruit. It's a beautiful combination of spices, that fruit. I think the passion fruit is one of those versatile ingredients that you can use for savory dishes and desserts. So I figure this is a perfect example of how we can cross-utilize an ingredient.
And you have that dispenser, as you call it, right at the front of the book, right?
Yes. And what it does is really give you a little guide of the things that you must have in your dispenser that will last forever, and they're going to be able to be versatile ingredients, and that you're going to be able to use throughout the book. So I figured, let me do a little of a guide so people know when they go to the supermarket what they should buy.
But you have to have an innate creativity about you for these recipes. It's not just taking traditional recipes and modernizing it. Vanilla mashed potatoes, that's incredible.
Vanilla bean mashed potatoes, exactly. It's almost thinking about ice cream, and I love the presence of contrast and balance. It is very important to have those two elements, contrast and balance in our foods. And the way that I do that is doing exactly that. You're presenting something sweet with something crunchy or something salty or something spicy, so you have a beautiful contrast in your mouth and in every bite. And so that's always what I'm looking for. And I figured, you know, I was going to make ice cream one day, and I figured, this is the perfect base to make a mashed potato. Let's see how it comes out. It came out delicious, actually.
So what do? You put ice cream in, with the potatoes?
No, actually, what I do is...
Oh, just vanilla, okay. I thought maybe you could put ice cream in with potatoes. That'd be two things.
No.
Oh, dear.
I took the vanilla, which is the vanilla bud, and simmer it in the milk and the butter that I use for the mashed potatoes. So I figured I use half for my ice cream, and the other half I'm going to put it on my mashed potatoes.
That's
and
come
on.
Sounds like a great idea.
What made you select food as a career?
Oh, wow. I was always passionate about food. I began my studies in law school, and I always had that passion and that sensitivity about food, and it was something that I was very close to. And it was weird because my family, they're no big foodies. My mother is an amazing cook, but she doesn't like to be in the kitchen that often. So I feel that I took that and then took it to the next level, and being here in the United States and having the opportunity to go to school and having a bachelor's degree was something that definitely caught my attention. So I finished law school, I came to the States, and I started culinary school immediately after that.
Now, we interviewed someone else in Miami who started out in law school as a law student and ended up as a culinarian. Who was that?
How would I remember?
I mean, we
talked to so many people. I'm lucky I can remember my own name.
Wouldn't that?
The way that I figure things work is like when you're passionate and you love, in this case, food and culinary arts, the chances of being successful doing something that you love are much bigger than just doing a career just for the money or for what it represents. So I think that follow your passion, and that way the chances of being successful are much higher.
Now, tell our listeners about this K Sabes thing. Tell me about this Sabes. Is it Sabes K or K Sabes?
Sabes K.
Sabes K.
Sabes K, you know what?
And it's Spanish, not Portuguese.
Okay, there you go.
In Spanish, it's Sabes K. It means you know what? And it is really a little capsule that I go through my chapters, giving you tips here and there and the different substitutions that you can use in the recipes or what you can do with ingredients besides the recipe. And I think that it was an interesting note that, you know, everybody likes to know where are the little tricks of the tray when you're cooking.
Right. I think that's a good idea. It just got me confused because I didn't understand the words. I did figure out the purpose, and I thought it was very, very worthwhile. And you have a couple of other sort of editorial sections, I think, where you write about getting prepared for cooking outside.
Absolutely. Well, the book also tells a little story about who I am and how I became a chef through, you know, why do I make food instead of mine that I feel. For example, on the weekend, something that I do very often is gather my family and my friends. We go to the pool or we go to the beach, living in Miami Beach, something that we do very often. So tons of recipes that do not require heat, or recipes that we do for picnics or for being outside or a pool party. And then we have, of course, the grill. I'm a big fan of the grill outside, so I have a chapter just dedicated to that, to grilling.
Let's play a little game. Let's suppose that I don't have any idea what I'm going to cook for dinner tonight.
Yes.
I do, but it's beside the point. How would I go about using her book to get ready to create something really nice and different that Anne would be really excited about?
Well, you have different ways of using the book. I mean, you can do it the traditional way, which you do if you decide to make, you know, a dinner or, you know, a full-on menu with appetizer, main course, and dessert, you can have it. And that is actually towards the end of the book. It teaches you how to maneuver the book in that way. You can actually simply just open the book, which is what I do, is open the book, and the picture that I like, I go for it.
Okay, there you go.
That looks delicious. I want to make this. And basically, my recipes are very easy to make, usually with ingredients that they're easy to find in any supermarket. So I was able to, you know, create these recipes that are being very accessible for everyone. And that's one of the key thoughts that I had when I made my book. I wrote every single recipe, and I tested every single recipe in my house, just making sure that every household is able to make this recipe and come out exactly the same.
So it's really for the home cook.
Yes, absolutely.
What's your... I know it's hard. It's a stupid question, too, but I really wanted to know, because you say you have such a mad sweet tooth.
That, yes.
Yes. I mean, what is the one dessert you'd recommend in your book?
Oh, wow. It is hard to choose because, for example, I have a peach cup that only has 100 calories, and I did this dish based on a show that I did that is called The Biggest Loser here in the States, and I created this recipe for the contestants, and it was a big hit.
Because you created recipes for The Biggest Loser?
Yes, absolutely. I created for them.
That's wonderful.
Yes, and this is one of the recipes actually that won that day, and it is because it has the consistency almost of an ice cream, but only with 100 calories. And I did it with peaches because it was seasonal. I used seasonal ingredients, but if you can use the fruit that it is on that season, whatever time you want to make it. But I also have my amazing raspberry and white chocolate bread pudding.
I'm a fan of bread pudding.
That is a little bit more indulgent, but at the same time, it is just amazing if you want to make it for a Sunday evening.
It's so, a little more calories than 100, though, I guess.
A little bit more, but, you know, I always promote portion control, and I think that you can always have everything in moderation.
So, yeah, I think that the current answer to The Biggest Loser is Dancing with the Stars. They kept putting all these fat people on there to lose weight.
Yeah, right? And they went through all the process. Like,
exactly. So, will you have your finger in so many different pots here? What would we view as the dominant one? Of course, there's your book. Let me repeat the title. It's Lorena Garcia's New Latin Classics, Fresh Ideas for Favorite Dishes. And I think that I have to endorse that your ideas are very fresh and creative. And
thank
then,
you.
And then you have your chain of restaurants starting, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're ongoing on television?
I'm ongoing on television. I'll be in the first quarter of next year in a big production that we did in English and one of the main primetime television channels. I also do my, you know,
Spanish
in Latin
language.
America. Yes, I have in Spanish language too, productions, and I am a collaborator for Univision, which is one of the largest Spanish-speaking networks here in the States. So, yeah, I have my plate full, but loving every minute of it.
And so now, Lorena, when the people from Dancing with the Stars call you next year, don't say no. say yes.
You know what? It's so funny because yesterday somebody asked me, if somebody has called you from Dancing with the Stars, would you go? And I'm like, you know what? I don't think so. I'm a lousy dancer.
I'll bet you are.
I can only dance salsa and merengue. That, I'm a good one.
Very good.
I want to learn how to tango, but I don't think so.
Well, thank you so much, Lorena, for joining us on the menu
this
today.
This book is delightful, Lorena.
And almost as delightful as it's all.
Oh,
thank
yes.
you, guys. I had an amazing time. You are sweethearts, and I loved our interview. I loved it.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Lorena.
Well, sweetheart, time sure flies. We're at the end of another program, and we hope that we'll see you all same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.